Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. This week, we'll be having a conversation about preparing for and engaging in a career in the STEM fields with a visual impairment.
We'll be speaking with Bonnie Lynn Sweenor, an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. And she's actually been doing research on just that topic. In fact, how today's episode came to pass was she contacted us because she wanted to interview Pete about his experiences training for and engaging in a career in physics. And we asked for permission to record that conversation and use it in an episode of Eyes on Success because we figured if she was interested, other people might be as well. But first, for our tip of the week, this week's tip is that with or without a visual or other print disability, a career in the STEM fields can be very rewarding, and that's science, technology, engineering, and math.
And we've certainly interviewed plenty of people in this show over the years who have had very rewarding careers in STEM.
In fact, I did a search using the handy search tool on our website where I typed science into the search box, and I believe I got 17 different episodes back, and some of them have been on science education, some of them have been on science careers, and all different ways that science can impact your life.
So if you have a visual impairment, don't let anyone dissuade you or discourage you from going into one of the STEM fields.
And if you need further reason to believe that, just listen to the rest of the show, and Pete will be going into all sorts of details about how he was able to get his training and do his career in spite of being blind.
Support for Eyes on Success is provided by
eSight, maker of digital eyewear designed to help improve vision for people with low vision and legal blindness. The technology can be used to read, see faces, and explore the world. More information is available at eSightEyewear.com. Let's start by meeting Bonnie Lynn and learning a little bit about her experiences getting trained as a scientist with a visual impairment.
My name is Bonnie Lynn Sweenor. I am an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins in the Wilmer Eye Institute. I am an epidemiologist, and my research focuses on examining how vision loss affects functioning and quality of life.
And are you visually impaired yourself?
I am, yes.
And can you just tell us a little bit about the state of your vision? And
sure. I have low vision. I certainly have useful vision. I have a macular disease, and unfortunately, my vision loss has been progressing over the past 10 years. So I still do pretty well, I'd say. But, you know, things like reading is hard, and identifying people, seeing their faces is hard for me.
Do you use any particular types of assistive technologies like closed-circuit TV systems or magnifiers?
Text-to-speech software is mostly what I rely on. I have used some closed-circuit TVs, but not all that often.
You're clearly used to relying on your vision and started losing your vision a lot later in life. How has that impacted your career and how you do things?
In lots of large ways and in lots of small ways, which is normally how I respond to that question. So I started losing my vision 10 years ago.
So you were through with your education by then?
No, I was not. And in fact, I mean, the truth is I had just applied to master's programs. And when this all sort of started happening and my vision was getting worse, I got very scared, and I got into Hopkins Masters of Public Health program, and I deferred because I didn't know what was going to happen because I was right in the middle of, you know, trying to understand what was going on with my vision. So it's changed the way I work in that, you know, I fatigue very easily when I read, so I've had to increasingly rely on text-to-speech. The facial recognition is maybe the smaller or hidden way it's changed the way I work. As a grad student, so I got my master's and then I continued on to my PhD all while the vision loss was happening. I at some point had to apply for accommodation, so more time with tests and homework assignments. I was really just trying to figure it out, truly.
But you finally made it through, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, I made it through my graduate career, you know, finally. I was a postdoc for a year, and now I'm back at Hopkins as faculty, so I guess I've made it that far, at least, right?
Right.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
This week's focus topic is Bonnie Lynn's research about how people with vision loss prepare for and engage in careers in STEM.
So what was your motivation for getting into the research that you're doing?
As I have, you know, continued to grow my research career, as well as try and manage and struggle through vision loss, it has become apparent to me that there are hurdles for someone in STEM careers, science, technology, engineering, and math, who are losing their vision or are visually impaired. And part of that has been also talking to people that have been successful in these types of careers and managing their vision loss and what tricks they have and what they've done, what programs are useful, can they be improved? And so that's sort of why I initially reached out to both of you, just to get your insight and your experience and how you've made it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If I give you maybe a quick summary of my own path through all of this. First of all, I was born with glaucoma, so I knew I was blind. So to me, blindness wasn't a big thing. It was kind of something you always had to accommodate to, and it wasn't unusual. But I must say, until I went to graduate school, I could hold a book maybe a few inches from my nose and read it. So I was very familiar with the visual world and things around me. I did start to have trouble the last couple of years of undergraduate school. My eyes weren't always reliable. As you said, you know, I got tired. There were some days I couldn't read, so I had to make sure I did my homework when my eyes were cooperating.
Yeah.
And just to put it in perspective, he was in college in the early 1970s. And so all of this nifty electronic adaptive technology didn't exist.
Right. That wasn't around. And then the summer before I went to graduate school, I had an eye surgery that left me totally blind that summer. And I had a fellowship to go to graduate school. And I said, well, you know, how am I going to do this? And I figured I had 3 months to learn the skills or relearn some skills that I needed to be in graduate school. So that's when I learned to use a cane for the first time. I actually knew Braille from when I was a kid, but I never used it because I relied on my eyes. It was a lot easier. So I relearned Braille, tried to learn Braille math, and I approached my professors a few months in advance because I knew what courses, you know, first-year physics students are going to take. And I made sure I could get my books recorded by what was then Recording for the Blind.
I see.
So just to explain where he had learned Braille was in kindergarten and first grade when they ascertained that there was no way he could see the board. He happened to live pretty close to a school for the blind. So he went to a school for the blind through fifth grade. That's where he learned all his Braille skills. But it was a constant battle with the teachers because he preferred to read print and they wanted him to read everything in Braille. But it did pay off later, having learned Braille at least once as a kid and didn't have to learn it from scratch before grad school.
Right.
And I would say for the most part through graduate schools, my eyes cleared somewhat. For books I couldn't get right away, I had my colleagues read them to me on cassettes. But my eyesight cleared up somewhat, so I was able to use CCTVs if I blew up the print with lots of magnification and contrast. And I used marker pens to write my assignments. And, you know, I struggled with it. If I wrote something down, I couldn't really read it all a month later. So, you know, a lot happens in your head. But I think, you know, you kind of learn to accommodate when your vision is an issue. You learn your brain, you know, gets the exercise of doing a lot and remembering a lot in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And then after graduate school, you came up here to Rochester, New York to join the research staff of Xerox.
when I hired at Xerox, again, I was still using a CCTV, and I was hired essentially as a computer modeler. So I would model kind of physical systems inside printers and what was going on in the lab. I always wanted to be an experimentalist. And in graduate school, my advisor said to me, you know, look, Pete, I have a lot of faith in you. I know you can do what you want. Just realize that if you want to be an experimentalist and work in the lab, which I was doing at the time, I was setting up some laser and vacuum systems. He said, it'll just take you a little bit longer. And, you know, at some point I sat down and I said to myself, you know, I'm a pretty pragmatic person. Although that was fun, there are other ways of having fun in life. And I decided in the end analysis to do a theoretical thesis, because I wanted to get out of graduate school and get on with life.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I got to Xerox, my solution was I was right across the hall from guys working in the lab, and I was in the lab a lot of the time, analyzing their experiments. They would come to me if they had some strange experimental results, and they'd ask me to model them. So that's how I sort of fulfilled my dream of being an experimentalist. And I considered myself running experiments on the computer. I always consider myself fortunate. Nancy pointed this out to me. Sometimes she has to point out these things because I take them for granted. But as she points out, my eyesight sort of decreased slowly over time through the 80s and early 90s. But during that time, the technology was also improving. So there were the first refreshable Braille displays. My first speech synthesizers, you couldn't understand them. But by the time I really needed them, they were a lot more clear and a lot more effective. And so, you know, we keep saying that my eyesight decreased as the technology improved, and more or less my access to material has been pretty constant and pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, through the transition, I would say that's true. But once your vision got below the point where you could actually use your vision at all, the technology continued to improve, and I would say your access now is a lot better functionally than it was 30 years ago when you were using magnification and closed-circuit TVs, because you would come home at the end of the day and your back would hurt and your neck would hurt and your eyes would hurt and you'd be exhausted.
Fortunately, I was a lot younger back then.
Yeah, and you were still exhausted.
True.
And now it's like you use the text-to-speech and you're happy as a clam, and the Braille display, and life is good.
Yeah, so the technology has made a huge difference. Mm. And I've always thought that, you know, it's interesting, you're in epidemiology, which, as you said, was primarily a data-driven discipline. I think computers are ideal for people with vision problems, because if you're good at computers, you know, you're competitive with all your peers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're really not at a disadvantage. Computers are very accessible, and the tools that are available, the ability to customize them and work with them, you know, specially, is really a great boon.
Yeah, yeah. I do still think that we have a little ways to go in certain aspects. I guess, you know, when I think of the population of people with low vision, I think of older adults, and I think of the people that maybe don't have the kind of resources needed to sort of make that initial investment. And those are the people I worry about.
And I agree with you. I think that's difficult. There's two classes of people that I think it's difficult for, which is probably the majority of people.
Yeah.
When you lose your vision later in life, you're not plugged into these resources.
That's right.
There's also a bit of denial. You don't want to be labeled as being quote unquote disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a tough transition. And the other group of people, which again is probably the majority of people, are people who are not all that technically savvy, which is particularly elderly people, right? Because they didn't grow up with these technologies.
Right.
I mean, I consider myself very lucky to be, you know, kind of a geeky physicist. I'm into these techie things. I just love wrestling with computers.
Yeah.
Well, and the third category of people for whom it's a major problem is people who don't have jobs with companies that are willing to buy the adaptive technology for them, or they don't have a governmental agency that's willing to buy the adaptive technology for them, because buying this stuff on your own can be really expensive.
Yes, I think it is a problem. You know, I will say, as someone who is in a STEM career and who is starting to, you know, who sort of started to lose my vision later in life, I guess I'd say, I still find it daunting, the learning curve on some of the software programs. know, I don't have time to do that.
Yeah, but you sure don't have the time not to do it.
Well, so that's the struggle, I think, is when, like you were saying, you're in this transition. I'm sure once I fully make this transition over, I would hope that my efficiency would increase, but it's hard to find the time to invest into that, right? Especially in a career that is, the clock is ticking as it is in academics.
Right.
So, Pete, did you experience any negative ramifications at Xerox? Did you feel like it, you know, people's perception of your vision impairment held you back in, you know, progression of your career?
My perception is no, that they were very supportive. And I think in general, they were. As Nancy said, you know, they always bought me all the equipment I needed. After I joined Xerox, I asked them if they had any concerns about hiring a blind person. They said, well, we figured if you got your PhD,
yeah,
obviously you could do the job and, you know, it was your issue.
Wow.
And they were usually very supportive. I mean, I eventually became a research fellow and manager, believe it or not, of the group that did the print quality specifications and the print quality image processing algorithms for our inkjet printers.
Oh, wow.
So they were very supportive in, you know, fostering my career and letting me do what I was capable of and wanted to do.
I'm always interested in people with vision loss. How do you do your day to day? Is there good public transportation where you are?
Well, you know, so when I moved to Rochester, I was single and in my late 20s, and I specifically thought, where do I want to live? And I specifically chose a section of town where I could walk to the supermarket. There were sidewalks, there were buses downtown, and where I knew other Xerox employees lived, and I might be able to join a carpool to get to work. And that's what I did for many years.
Right.
You know, and when I got married and later on we wanted to move to the suburbs, we chose homes where I could walk to the community center or, you know, walk to a nearby store. It's not quite as perfect as being in a downtown area.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by then I had Nancy and the kids to help guide me around and all. So.
Well, and we also made sure to find a location where, even though it wasn't as dense as living downtown, that if something happened to me, like maternity leave, for example, or if I was out of town at a business meeting or something, that you could always get a ride and there would be a sufficient number of other people who worked in the same building who would be happy to give you a ride.
So, okay, so that's how you did it. So what do you think are the biggest hurdles then to someone with vision loss getting into a STEM career?
You know, as you said, it is not easy having a visual impairment. There is always going to be, I think, some extra effort. You know, you have to be a little bit more proactive than kind of your peer, just because some things may take more time, may take more effort, may take more creativity to find a different way of doing things.
Yeah.
So, you know, it takes a person that's a little bit stronger in those areas, I think. The other thing I think is a big disincentive is how the education and the sort of social services people think of visually impaired people. You know, you take a visually impaired person when they're young, how many people are telling them you can become a scientist, you can program computers?
Right.
Well, you know, those are easier skills than some of the jobs they do push them into sometimes.
That's right.
And I find that very discouraging.
Yeah.
I think the biggest obstacle that a blind youth faces in trying to pursue, well, anything, but including a STEM career, it's a toss-up between their own personal attitude and the attitudes of others. And, you know, there's just so many times you can listen to people saying, oh, you can't do that, you're blind, before you start to accept that as being valid. And one of the things that we do on this show, we interview people who've done all sorts of stuff in spite of being blind. And there's very few limitations.
Yeah, you know, I've sort of binge listened to some of your podcasts lately. And I never get tired of hearing those success stories, I guess, right? You know, and it's always great to hear. So I'm very glad that I found you guys and your podcast. But in addition to, you know, the work that I have described, I'm developing an area of research in stigma of vision loss. And it's all of those things you said. There's internalized stigma, there's external stigma from the community, what blind and visually impaired people can and cannot do. And then the individual internalizes that eventually, hopefully not, but could, and then they self-limit, right? And I am very interested in better understanding that so that maybe we could develop either at a community level or an individual level, better strategies to manage or change that. Because I think that that stigma, what you just described, is the reason there's such a high unemployment rate in people with vision loss and blindness.
Right. And you have to catch these people when they're young.
Yeah. Well, you know, except for what do you do when someone develops glaucoma late in life or AMD late in life, right? I think that's, there's stigma from their family members. There's even stigma from physicians.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. And we've talked to many people who have lost their vision later in life and have quit their careers.
Yes.
Yeah, but we've also talked to people who lost their vision well into their career. And in particular, we did a show just a couple months ago with a pharmacist, and he was going along. He had a bit of a visual problem, but when it got really bad, he went back to school, got another master's degree, and he actually wound up at a higher level, continuing to use his pharmaceutical background, but became kind of a higher level, well, not employee. He bought the pharmacy and then he hired all these other people, and he was running a, you know, a substantial business.
Yeah.
So some people have said, oh, wow, I'm losing my vision. I better go get some more training and then I can do something that it's possible to do with vision loss that may not be what I was doing. I mean, George Kircher, who developed the first digital books that were accessible to the blind, he was a school teacher and he lost his vision. He's like, well, this isn't going to work so well, although we have interviewed a number of school teachers and college professors who are blind. And so he went back to school, he got some education in computer science, and before he finished his degree, he had developed the first digital books that the blind could access. So it goes both ways.
And you yourself began losing your vision as you were going through graduate school, and that didn't discourage you from obtaining your PhD. So it can be done.
You too, Pete.
So when you were in grad school in the early parts of your career, did you have a mentor, you know, of vision loss?
Not mentors with vision loss. I would pick mentors who were doing well in their careers or, you know, I thought I could learn from professionally. But the vision loss thing was mostly on my own. These agencies for the blind, they really not in a position to help people like that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, just in my experience, there's I know a few people in related fields that have vision impairments, and even a 5-minute conversation with them, how do you do this? How do you figure this out? Is so helpful for me, you know?
Yeah, I think it is. And that's the power of the internet.
Yeah.
There are becoming more and more resources like that where people can share this through email forums, web posts, like the American Foundation for the Blind's Vision Aware site.
Yeah.
And they share lots of tips for how do I pour water into a glass without spilling it? How can I cook an egg?
Right.
And, you know, just simple things that who are you going to ask?
Right. That's right. Yeah, for sure. You know, low vision rehab is underutilized, and that's really sort of the clearinghouse to help people identify that stuff, or it should be. Mm-hmm. There's problems in, one, referring people to low vision rehab, and, you know, that's a whole nother conversation. There's a problem in getting people to actually go to low vision rehab, and that's, I think, a mix of this stigma, a mix of cost, and not fully understanding what can be done or what is available. But I really do believe that the gateway to these resources, both the accessibility tools and the communities, really could be and should be a good low vision rehab specialist.
Mm-hmm. And I fault some of the ophthalmologists for that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of these ophthalmologists, they're seeing these people with these vision problems and, you know, they know how to fix an eye or not, or give you drops, and they know how to maybe keep your pressure under control, stop your macular degeneration from progressing. But they don't talk about lifestyle.
No.
They barely know about some of these low vision places where they make specialized glasses, telescopes for driving, all sorts of assistive devices, large print cards. And they really should be the people in charge of directing people to these places.
That's exactly right. And in fact, I was part of some research that I'm in the middle of analyzing the data, but glaucoma specialists were surveyed to ask about their low vision referral practices, their perception of low vision. And it's very clear that they, A, don't fully understand what is available for their patients. B, some just don't understand who should be referred and who shouldn't be referred. But a lot of them asked for help. They said there should be continuing medical education credits to help us. Mm-hmm. Some were very honest in this anonymous survey and said, you know, I don't have time to talk to my patients. Some said, if I tell my patient to go to low vision, I've failed as their clinician. I'm essentially saying there's nothing I can do for you, and I struggle with that.
Mm-hmm.
Now for this week's final item, how to reach Bonnie Lynn Sweenor and how to learn more about her research into today's topic and other related ones about how visual impairment and eye disease affect functioning and quality of life, especially in older adults.
So if people wanted to contact you, how can they go about that?
They can email me at B as in boy, S as in Sam, W-E-N-O-R, at jhmi.edu. So bsweenor at jhmi.edu. That's my email address. That's the best way. And I would love to hear from people. I'm always interested in people's perspectives driving my research questions is what I'm hoping to use that as.
And do you have a website that describes the organization you work for or some of your own work?
There is a website. I work in what is called the Dana Center for Preventive Ophthalmology and the Wilmer Eye Institute. And we have a website, danacenter.org. And that is the group I work with within Wilmer. And we're all focused on public health aspects of ophthalmology and vision loss. And then under people, you can find me under faculty.
And as usual, we'll have all of the contact information and other resources in the show notes associated with this show at www.eyesonsuccess.net.
That's it for show number 1551. Next week on Eyes on Success will be our annual year-end special. And this year's year-end special will include some highlights from 2015, some very interesting user comments that we've received, and some information about Eyes on Success that was excerpted from an interview that John Shea of the Talking Information Center, or TIC, did of us on their Mission Possible show in September. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. Browse the full archive of programs, find instructions for subscribing to the podcasts, and much more at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also find us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com, at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at _EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success and have a nice day.